Good morning, and I would like to thank you all for joining us in another of our Ag in Uncertain Times webinar series. I'm John Newkirk. I'm an extension economist and director of the WSU Western Center for Risk Management Education, and I'm operating from Grand Junction, Colorado today. It's a great thing about this distance technology. Just about anywhere you can get a good wireless connection, you can be ready to go. And joined with us here is our advisory committee for our Western Center, sitting in on this today, and we're having a great meeting. So our webinar series, as those of you who have been with us before know, it's designed to provide information to help producers and others meet the challenge of today's uncertain economy. And there's no apparent sense on the horizon that it's getting any less challenged. And this morning, it's the final in our marketing series, where we're going to cover some analysis tools and or procedures that are available and talk very specifically, kind of a wrap-up in what's happened before. We have two great presenters today, and there will be an opportunity for questions of them after each presentation. And if you have a question, please enter it in the little chat panel over there to the left of the screen. And we will see that those questions, as long as there's time, are given to the presenters. Again, so if you have questions that you want to give to the presenters, enter them in the chat box at the left. Also, if you're having some kind of a technical difficulty, enter it there. We have several members of our team that are operating behind the scenes. They'll get back to you directly. And for the most part, we've been able to solve most of the problems, which have mostly been simply audio. Sometimes have been able to solve those. Oftentimes it has to do with bandwidth on the internet connection that you have. So today's speakers are Don Thilmany from Colorado State University, an extension professor of agribusiness and she's an agribusiness extension economist. I'll say just a bit more about Don in a minute. And Raleigh Curtis, who is with the Mid-Columbia Producers out of Morrow, Oregon. We're really pleased to have both Don and Raleigh, who have committed their time to come and be with us today. We, again, a plug to our Ag in Uncertain Times webpage. And at the end of the webinar today, we'll have a file that you can easily download to your computer that has all of these web addresses. But all of our past webinars are there. They're recorded. They're available for viewing, as well as all of the slides presentations of each of the presenters. And there are a number of excellent presentations that are useful. Also, you might want to incorporate them in a meeting with producers or a 20-minute segment, because there is really, our presenters have invested a lot and put together some excellent presentations. And what's next in our series? We're back again on October the 7th, and our whole series is about working with farm families in times of uncertainty. And again, another excellent set of presenters for that series that starts on October the 7th. We have polling questions, which we'd like you to fill out. Some of them are repeats from before. Please do them again. It's really very simple. Just bring your cursor over and click on the answer that fits for you. This one is the question in the county that you're located in. If for some reason this polling pod, you can't see the bottom of it, I'm told by our technical team it probably has to do with the resolution at which you have your computer set. Please vote quickly, and we'll move through these so that we can get to the essence of our program this morning, which is the presentations of our presenters. How many individuals are participating at your location? This has some Merritt, I happen to know here in Grand Junction, not in the room that I'm in, but where our advisory accounting council is meeting, there's another 11 or 12 people there. And in other webinars in the past, we've had this projected to as many as 50 people in a room. So it helps us get some sense and understanding about the nature of our audience. Is, it really does help us think about our future series, which is going to run on through December. And if there's sufficient demand and follow-up on some of these, the team is more willing to work with any of you out there to continue possibly on a once a month to really hone in on some of the issues here and helping producers work through these uncertain times. My opening slide, very quickly it went through the team that's working on this and putting this together. And we've had several of our speakers, and I hope it's been true for you, tell us that we've probably solved, or that technically has moved as smoothly as any of the webinars that they've been a part of or seen. The technology isn't perfect yet, but the reason that is because our team operates in the background and makes sure questions are answered, things are taken care of, and help keep me out of trouble, and they can send me little arrows here on the side to make sure I stay on target and don't wander, as us preacher's kids are wont to do sometimes. We're really pleased to have Dawn with us from Colorado State University. Not her full bio, but a lot of the information about why she is extremely well qualified to come and talk to us this morning is up on our Ag and Uncertain Times webpage, has a great deal of experience in the area that we've asked her to visit about, and in both the research and the extension side of this, and I have the privilege of working with Dawn on a couple of projects. And so, Dawn, without further ado, I'm going to turn this to you, and the program's yours for the next 20 minutes or so.
Thanks for that gracious introduction, John. And I assume everyone can hear me okay, unless I see notes differently. But I am Dawn Thomany, and I was very thankful to be asked to do this from the Ag and Uncertain Times team. It's always good to get a chance to get around, interact with professionals across the region and the country who are thinking hard about the same things we think about. And the challenge that was posed to me when I was asked to do this was to, in a fairly short amount of time, hit on some of the highlights of what I see as being the important principles and first steps and tools that producers would want to take as they try to both look for all the opportunities and potential and face some of the risk that they might face as they go out and do their operations. And to give due credit, most of these are not my original ideas, but lessons I've picked up watching the people who have done this successfully do it well, and trying to note with an academic eye what patterns I see about what is working and what's not working. So in the small amount of time we have here today, I'm going to try to hit on primarily three things. Even though it seems like a 10,000-foot level topic, strategic planning is a really important first step, and I'll try to motivate a little bit why, even though that sometimes feels not very action-oriented, it has helped a lot of really successful niche marketers have a clear, unified vision of what they're doing with their marketing plans from day one. Second, I want to spend a little bit of time talking about some things that are going on in the marketplace where people who maybe feel like niche markets aren't even something they can still go after individually, even if they are smaller markets than the larger, broader commodity markets. And so we've seen more and more activity around producers and organizations finding shared values and doing alliances. And finally, talk a little bit about cost-effective promotion. And really what this is about is connecting with your market and your customers and trying to become irreplaceable in their eyes. And some of what we're finding about the ways that people are doing that cost effectively. So we talked about this a little last week for those of you who joined the webinar series then, but just to make sure we're all on the same page, when I think of niche markets, I think of them as segments within the larger target audience, especially if you're looking at a marketing perspective. It's about customers and how you can come up with well-defined customization of your product or service at a smaller scale to really more truly meet the needs of a set of consumers who seem to place value on that. So one of the first steps we've generally worked with producers on here as a research principle is to try to find ways to identify those customers and grouping them. And we started out as economists doing that a lot by demographics or maybe buying behavior, but more and more so with some of the belief that there's a growing consumer activism and people who are trying to vote with their dollars, also trying to find people who are motivated in similar ways. And then once you figure out how to group your customers, figuring out how to communicate with them so that they know you're meeting their needs or interests. So what we start with, again, even though it's at a 10,000-foot level, is making sure that the producers are doing really deliberate planning. And we can't talk about that in too much detail, but one thing I always encourage producers or producer organizations to do is to develop a mission statement, and that's basically a way for them to talk about what they're committed to. And part of that is because that mission statement is as important inside the organization as how you market to other people, because it makes sure everybody does have a unified vision of what their organization's about and what their values are and what they're committed to. Generally out of that, we try to start pulling some objectives about where they want to be, especially if they right now cannot meet all of what they want to be as they explain it in their mission statement. And so out of that generally follow some strategies which are kind of our roadmaps on how they want to get to some of their goals. And in the area of niche marketing, generally the roadmap is about customer identification, possibly a little bit about coming up with the right pricing, but mostly about customer identification and how to find and connect with those customers. And so what then our goal for those of us who are trainers ourselves and providing the technical assistance is really our first step is to make sure they have their problem statement down to small enough statements that the actions that they can take are realistic steps they can take without getting overwhelmed, or that they can engage partners in helping them do, and it takes it from that 10,000 foot level of the mission statement down to an action plan. And three rules I found for niche markets off of entrepreneur.com are that you make sure you meet their unique needs, which is why we're going to talk a little bit about customer segmentation, that you say the right thing, which gets back to the having the right messages given by the right people in a credible way, and then they also recommend test marketing, and that's finding ways to start with very small, minimal capital investments before you invest, especially in irreversible investments in facilities and so forth. You test market first to find out where that is. And we can talk about this a little bit, but a lot of people would argue that that is part of why we've seen the boom in farmers markets across the country, is they have become the test markets and niche market incubators for many of the food systems in our country. Okay, so how do we identify niche markets? Like I said, we in the past, and if you even think of how media buys used to happen, it was bought by demographics. That is very much so switched in the last 20 years, so that now more and more of the identification of markets is by like-minded groups looking at their political actions, their lifestyle actions, their motivations, and other materials they read if you look at how the larger marketing industry is starting to group people. What we've tried to work with producers on doing here at Colorado State, and there's more and more literature out there so that many times you don't even have to do this yourself, is that you try to find ways to group people by their motivations. Many times it's by their preferences for production practices. Sometimes it's about their commitment to the place that they live. Sometimes it's about their commitment to the environment. But we usually find ways to group them either using kind of sophisticated research all the way down to just doing some simple little marketing research exercises wherever you do market, and then kind of almost branding those customers themselves and giving them a name. And I'll give you an example here in a bit of a study I did on Natural Meats with the Colorado Homestead Ranch Group. This clustering of customers does three really important things. First, it allows you to come up with kind of a potential market size, really what it is likely you actually could sell, depending on how broadly or narrowly you define the group you're going to try to go after. Second, it generally allows you to come up with way better marketing materials and marketing strategies because you're not shooting for the average consumer anymore. You have a very clear vision about the people you're connecting with and what they want to know about you, hear from you, and have you give them assurances about. And then third, we also find it's generally fairly helpful with pricing as well, because we get a good idea of how strong their values are about things, and for that reason how much they're possibly willing to pay. So for the example that we have, one of the examples that we have done here at Colorado State was what we call a cluster analysis of natural meat customers for Colorado Homestead Ranches in Western Colorado. They were very, very gracious to let us actually do a national survey, even though it was only for their market area, in exchange for our help. And what we actually really found at that point in time, although this is over 5 years old now, is that there were five clusters of different types of individuals out there. And as you can see from the percentages, that kind of maps out the market share we talked about before. We weren't overly rigorous about trying to figure out how that matched up to the total volumes of meat that they did, but we kind of just more broadly defined it. And although we're not giving you a lot of details here, we could identify a couple of those using a lot of different factors and measures to come up with who were the most likely to be customers of their business. And for instance, we found really that the quality seekers, who were 13% of the market, and the health and natural consumers, who were 13% of the market, were the most likely buyers. But even among those two target customer groups, they had very different reasons to want to buy. And so the marketing materials they developed, and actually even the market venues they probably found some of those customers at, were quite different. This is a little busier of a graph, but this shows how we use that same information and groupings to look at willingness to pay. And part of why we knew two of those groups were our most likely customers is because Homestead Ranches, to meet the goals they had for making returns to the producers, did have to charge above at that time what was the commodity price in the market. So if you can see the tallest bars for all four products, ground beef, ribeye steak, a beef stroganoff, and a chili verde value-added product they've done, those were the two groups that we had identified also had like values to what they were doing with their operations. So we also used that for pricing, and all, those basically equated to 40 to 50% premiums they could charge above commodity prices if they chose to. And a final word on that. This was a fairly sophisticated national study, and I realize that is well beyond what most people can do with their niche marketers. But what we're finding more and more is people are doing creative things at the farmers markets they go to, the community-supported ag operations they're partnering with, or even the storefronts that they may be selling through, to find some of this exact same information through much more informal surveying or feedback mechanisms. And we'll talk about that a little bit at the end, but we can also certainly talk about that in questions. So this is one cartoon I found because I've given enough of these presentations that I also do believe that there is over-diversification that can happen and that we can get too far afield from our core mission to do anything well. So I do encourage that we think hard about how we change and diversify in smart and deliberate ways, and not taking advantage of every change of wind we feel is out there with consumer preferences. So one thing I wanted to draw into, even though it seems somewhat far afield in niche markets, is what's going on with value-based food supply chains in the marketplace. Even though niche markets are considerably smaller, we still see a lot of producers who feel overwhelmed with the idea of changing their business model so significantly that all of their core competencies as a producer and traditional marketer are almost lost in the new marketplace. So what we've seen more and more activity around is people cooperatively coming together, not necessarily as cooperatives, but cooperatively in some business organizations, to team up with strategic partners who have skill sets they don't feel that they have, and rebuilding their supply chains and calling them value chains. And specifically, this is work out of the Ag of the Middle Group, that is a new regional research committee that represents across the country. And their idea is that these supply chains are based on producers and businesses who have collaborative principles, and treat each other very much as equals in the value chain, and have commitments to fair returns to all members of the value chain. And for instance, some of the case studies they did in that project were natural country beef up in Oregon and Shepherd's Grain in the Northwest, and Organic Valley, which is an organic producer supply chain across the country. And I guess I just want to bring that up because even one of the first groups we worked with, the homestead ranches and beef example that I've been talking about, was a collaborative of five producers who I'm pretty sure would has grown to even a few more people today, but would tell you none of them would have been able to do alone what they've done so well as a group. And so some of this is possibly us, even as producers or technical assistants, encouraging people to look for places where there can be collaborative efforts as well. And part of the challenge of working with groups trying to come together is making sure that you identify and build core competencies that they all believe in, they all believe are distinctive enough with their consumers that it sets them apart, and that they can do better than competitors, and that it's built on some core competency, we call it, that is something that's not very replaceable in the marketplace, so that it does have unique value that cannot be competed away. And we'll talk a lot today about examples that are production protocols, but those also can happen in the area of customer service, these unique alliances that do build stronger relationships with retailers, restaurants, institutional buyers, or unique resources such as heritage or a historical founding within your industry or region. So finally, I want to switch to getting your message out, and with the idea that it's not too useful to identify your niche market, identify the customers that are in that, or develop partnerships that allow you to bring that into different sizes of the marketplace if you don't have a good message and cost-effective way to connect with people. So I want to highlight a couple of things today, including something that is new to our state as well called Market Maker, but which is a national project going on, which started in Illinois and is now up to 18 states and is becoming one of the mechanisms that is being standardized across the country as a way to help people connect. And in a quick soundbite, it basically has portals where consumers can find their producers in different locations and different product categories. The producers can promote their operations and have a web presence, even if it's slight, if it's been too much for them to actually do that in a more targeted way. And quite honestly, we're also telling producers to use it as a way to do pretty free or cheap research, because they can immediately see how other people in their product categories are marketing themselves and actually use that as a way to emulate those who are doing a good job, maybe not even just in their state, but in the other states that are represented in this project. So just as a quick example, and I realize the font on this is small, this is what a search looks like in the Market Maker, where in the background, you can see a listing of all farmers markets in the state of Colorado, including some buttons you can hit to email those sites, go to their websites, or map the sites. And as an example, I did click on the web link to one of the specific farmers markets in the foreground, and it shows you that it's at most usually a two-step process for a consumer to find something they may be looking for in the local food system. And we're encouraging people who are in states that have this project to use this as a resource, because there's a lot of infrastructure there that would otherwise be very costly for the producer to do themselves. So we think of it as a cost-effective option. And as an example of where I've pointed people to look at where they can do market research, and just because I thought this was a clever example of the niche marketing I've been talking about, is this is a producer that I found using Market Maker, who did a really good job building up the value to his customers by everything that's being offered free at their farm. But it was also very savvy and giving some price points and giving comparisons to what the customer would pay for the same product at a local market. But all of that is after this particular person talked about everything that was free. So again, this isn't just the example of the farm I'm pointing out. It was the fact this was one thing I found just doing a really quick and light search on Market Maker, and it's what I've encouraged producers to do so they can find out what is going on in the marketplace besides them. Another thing that we took on this summer at the request of actually an agritourism project we're doing is looking a little bit at social marketing, which was a very new thing for me, but I've learned a lot in just the time I've worked on this project. But it's basically this viral marketing or networking, or for those of you who are at the risk management education meetings in spring, this tribal marketing that we're hearing about, where people don't want to hear very formal marketing messages anymore. They want to hear from their friends and people they trust what they're doing and enjoying. So we actually did an experiment on this with some producers here this summer. And the first thing we found, looking at just even the broader literature, is that of the current social marketing sites, Facebook is the most widely used across the broadest set of demographics and the stickiest, and by stickiest I mean people spend the most time there. In an experiment we did with three producers, including one control group where someone had a presence but did absolutely nothing on the Facebook site, is that there was a very, very nice payback for even the smallest amount of time spent on establishing a presence at Facebook, even if you didn't have another web presence. And so what the table basically quickly shows is that even for as little as one-third of an hour per week, up to 10% of the website traffic for a farm did come from other people getting the word out about this farm, it quickly growing a web presence. And then if you look at a bigger farm we have here that spent significantly more time and 5 hours a week, it drove a significant amount of their web traffic. And so even though this is very tentative results, I did want to point out that there's some evidence that tribal marketing does work, especially within local food systems. But what we have not been able to find any good evidence of is how it translates to sale. So we definitely think it develops a sense of community, but we don't feel like it's translating at least directly to sales through some couponing experiments we've done. That does not look like it's clear. So we feel it's an encouraging thing to do, especially to learn about your customers and what they're most interested in, but it isn't necessarily going to be the only thing you do to have a marketing strategy within your business. And finally, even though these are examples from Colorado, we do encourage all producers and all of you who work with producers to make sure you know about all the free listings and directories there are and make sure people get in them. They have become higher and higher used resources, at least in our state, and I think that's true in many of our states. So finally, one thing I usually end a lot of my presentations on is opportunity is missed by most people because it is dressed in overalls and looks like work. And what I tell people is there is no quick and easy way to develop your market and develop a relationship and community with your customers. It takes much thoughtful consideration. And it, even though we're talking about marketing here, behind that should always be discussions and concerns about what the financial implications are, what it means for your personal life, including a loss of privacy and autonomy, and that it honors the values you have about your way of participating in agriculture and the food community. And these are just 5 steps. Again, I ask people to revisit after they've decided the niche market they're going to go after. But I know I'm running out of time, so let's just summarize by saying that niche marketing is generally considered a growing segment of agribusiness strategies, but we still see that most people are only using it as one enterprise diversification strategy coupled with some other things they may want to do. And we only encourage it when it's tapping into an underutilized resource. It takes a lot of time. So when people come to us and say it's something they want to do, we usually try to help them identify, even though it will help create revenue streams, what resources are going to help them create those revenue streams. And if there are no Slack resources, make them think hard about whether it's possible and make them realize that it takes very different management and marketing skills and requires very careful consideration, because once you start personalizing your farm business and your products and need to have conversations with people face to face about what you represent, you need to make sure you as a producer have a solid grounding about what those answers are. And so with that, I'm happy to take questions, and I'm sorry if I went a little long.
This is Dwayne Griffith. For those of you attending, I'm in the background, and some of the questions that we have is, if you have a single step you'd advise individuals who are marketing to niche markets take to protect themselves and share for that coming year, what is that single step?
What we have found is that it's all about making your business or your community you've built as irreplaceable as possible. So what I've seen the most successful people doing in the last couple of growing seasons successfully is having events and experiential opportunities that make people feel like they're part of the business family almost. And that has seemed to be a real significant indicator of whether customers become core customers that are very loyal and come back relative to some other operations who've treated it purely like a business and maybe only delivered on the contract there was for the community supported ag or the contract with the restaurant. Those people have had a little more trouble faring as even more producers have come into this direct marketing land. But really it's been about experiential. Even the natural country beef people make sure everyone who comes into their alliance realizes they're going to be spending time in stores, in the locations that have committed to them as retailers long ago, giving their customers the assurances and answers they want. So it's really about moving beyond the product to providing experiences and connections with the customer and consumer base so that it's much easier to think of it about think of any product or producer as interchangeable.
Okay, thank you. As we make the transition here to our next speaker, Raleigh, another question. Well, I'm going to ask you too. Could you provide the contact information for the market maker program? Excuse me.
The only one I know is our state's, and that's all one word, ColoradoMarketMaker.com. But on any one state site, there is actually a graphic and a link for you to get to the National Market Maker site so that you can go to any state that's in the network.
Okay. And one more quick question here. Niche markets relative to what I would call or refer to as kind of the basic commodity markets, do you have information on your past research that would indicate what the responsiveness is in those niche markets to price changes, without using the term, the income elasticity in the economy, the demand elasticity in those kinds of markets?
Yeah, it's been kind of unique. What you see happening is not masking of the price changes, but generally some rebundling. So when I've had producers who've had to do some price changes to meet their return goals, a lot of times they'll do an offsetting change somewhere else in their plan. So, for instance, I know with the Homestead beef example again, they were really troubled by the fact that they actually wanted some of their product to be cost-effective for some of their community members. So they actually knew they needed to hit some different goals. So I think they've done most of their price changing upward on their middle meat premium cuts because that seems to be among a consumer group that is way less affected by price, and I'm sure this year maybe that has changed. And at the same time, then, they did some larger value bundles or some products like ground meat that they could offer actually even at possibly a more affordable price so that there was always an option to tell people that if this is not affordable for you, we have some other options that maybe aren't your first choice but are just as affordable. And I think there's at least evidence in northern Colorado this is why the community-supported agriculture movement has taken such hold, is that has become, for people who felt farmers markets were becoming too boutique, that has become the cost-effective way to get produce in this region, because for the volume you get and the assurance it gives to the producer for revenue, it is far more cost-effective than the average farmers market basket. Plus, a lot of those CSAs have now added bundles from fruit growers, mushroom growers, cheese producers, and so forth. So we actually see most of the affordability discussions happening with people transitioning from direct sales at farmers markets to the CSA models or buying clubs.
Thank you.
Thanks for your attention, everybody. I appreciated it.
We're going to shift now to Raleigh Curtis, and he's the past general manager of Mid-Columbia Producers. He's got many years of experience in grain marketing, and our Western Center has been pleased to be able to collaborate with Raleigh with a series of marketing workshops as well.
Well, thank you for the invitation to participate in this program, and As a young farmer, I decided that if I was going to be successful, I needed to be a better marketer. Woke up one day as a potato grower, and the potato contracts had changed to where all of a sudden, instead of knowing a price I was going to get for the next year's potatoes, part of them had to be raised on the open market with no price assurance. Now, that bothered the dickens out of me. We all need to understand that we can and should shape our own future. The reality is, if you don't, someone else surely will. Well, managing risk and being a good marketer are very much akin of each other, but they're not exactly the same thing. When we buy land, we know we're going to grow a crop, or and some of us, depending on which areas we live in, are going to grow some soybeans, some corn, some wheat, or maybe some potatoes or sugar beets, maybe alfalfa, maybe we're cattle ranchers. We all have different types of risk, and that risk lies in managing our cost of production and what types of production we're going to do, trying to predict our costs into the future. With the cost of production forecast into the future, then we have to look at price. What are we going to be able to sell those animals for? Or what are we going to be able to sell the different products that we're going to grow? Can we forward contract? Do we sell in the current market? What do? Then, of course, if we're grain producers, if we sell using the futures market, we have basis risk. Then there's relative value. If I'm a corn producer and the price of wheat is cheap, then that's definitely going to impact what my high price in corn is going to be, and vice versa if I'm a wheat producer. And the price of corn is low, then the potential downward price trend in wheat can be as low as that price of corn because some wheat's going to get fed. Then we have substitution. What can we substitute for what? Today's commodity prices are created by supply and demand, and to be honest with you, as a marketer, I like marketing price commodities that are tied to futures markets, because in futures markets, the prices beyond today are created by speculative value coupled to the speculative value of time, which creates in years of shortage marketing opportunities for multiple years in the future. Whereas if you're a potato producer or a producer of perishable products, the time value, the time that you have to market that crop is very limited. Well, what about high prices? In 78 out of the last 91 years, wheat prices increased an average of 10 to 15% after harvest. In 11 of those 91 years, the increase was 40% or more. Unpredictability. The unpredictable drivers were war, politics, drought, and wetness. If we look at the last 20-year trend in price for, and this is soft white wheat, the high up until 3 years ago was $6.13. The high price 2 years ago was over $15.50. The current price is $4.64. The 20-year average is $4.09, and the low price was $2.60, which was in, I believe, 1999 or 2000. The reality is that markets are very predictable. High prices, most generally, brings low prices. Let's get to laying out how we market. Over the last 40 years, my goal has been to learn to develop products and tools to help myself and my fellow farmers to create greater wealth. One day I was on an airplane, and I happened to be sitting next to a behavioral psychologist who was traveling back to L.A. from Chicago. And he had been hired by the Chicago Board of Trade to help understand why traders behave the way they do. Marketing, rather than price taking, requires knowing what you want and preparing assumptions and action steps. Marketing, rather than price taking, is a very mental endeavor. Strong emotional control and the right set of core beliefs are essential for self-help and economic success. Most professional traders have a common goal of capital appreciation from marketing decisions, not speculation on non-trending commodity moves. When I buy a bushel of wheat from a producer, what I do with that bushel of wheat once I bought it is determined by what the trends in the markets are telling me to do with that bushel of wheat. Today, I want to be short a bushel of wheat. I want to have sold a bushel before I buy a bushel because the market trend is definitely downward. The market is telling us, and the International Grains Council, the USDA, anything we read, that we're going to have the largest carryout of wheat at the end of this marketing year that we've had since 2001. That does not bode well for price. So these are moves that it creates predictability. We have predictability in the market. But what do we do as marketers? Now, here's the big thing that I've learned from behavioral psychologists. And I've hired several over the last 25 years to help me understand myself and my fellow farmers. Do you know you? We're a product of our personal belief structure. How will you feel if you contract a portion of next year's wheat crop for $9.50 and the price when harvest arrives is at $3? How will you feel if the price when harvest arrives is $16? Well, what if that portion was 25%? Let's think about this. We sold some $9.50 wheat, but when harvest arrives, it's $3. We're going to feel darn good about that sale, aren't we? Well, if the price was $16, we wouldn't feel so good about that sale. We'd still think about that sale, even though that portion was only 25%. Making profit is seldom the real emotional goal when we sell or at what price. It's the means to an end, a currency that buys us emotional states such as feeling safe, feeling proud, feeling free, feeling right. Let's think about this. Has this ever happened to you? Joe Farmer sold 25% of his expected wheat crop for harvest delivery at $7.65, saying it was a great sale. Did he have a good reason? He sure did. It was a price well above the average price for the past several years. You knew it was a good profitable price and knew he would have at least that many bushels. As is always the case with regret syndrome markets, remember this, regret syndrome markets, the price went up and up after the sale. In fact, to Mr. Farmer, it almost seems that the wheat market had become aware that he had sold his wheat and used this information as a catalyst to move up and up more and more over the next several days and months. Then something weird happened. He found himself rooting that the market would go lower. After all, since he still owned 75% of the wheat crop, and every move higher was making him money. But every move up was also a stinging rebuke of his completely arbitrary but financially sound decision to forward sell 25% of the crop at $7.65. The resulting conclusion is inescapable. Joe literally found himself wanting to lose money. Why would Joe Farmer ever want to do that? It's simple. Behavioral psychologists have found that we find ourselves valuing emotional return as even more important than the financial return. In most cases, our financial, emotional self is poorly conditioned. We as marketers, as educators, as extension agents have focused on making sure we teach and help people to grow more, but we have never really hit on the core needs to help our farmers make more. I would dare to say that there are very few, if any, on the staff at the universities that are behavioral psychologists that are helping us to help ourselves to understand why we make financial decisions the way we do. Making profit is seldom the real emotional goal when we sell or at what price. It is the means to an end, a currency that buys us emotional states such as feeling safe, feeling proud, feeling free, feeling right. Unfortunately, sometimes our emotional goals and financial goals are incompatible. Being aware of our secret reasons for making financial decisions, emotional return on investment is what helps us overcome our psychology and navigate through the emotional minefield of purchasing and marketing decisions. Now let's ask a question. How have the high prices of the last 2 years impacted the selling of the current year's wheat crop? I can tell you from my experiences in dealing with farmers and making presentations throughout the Pacific Northwest that we have very few farmers that have forward contracted into the next several years or even forward contracted into this year, even though they've had enormous opportunities. Why? Because they missed the $15 price. Planning for the future, emotional. When I deal with farmers and we talk about making a marketing plan, the first thing I insist on is that we first deal with the emotional parts of setting that plan. We must have decisive action that happens only if we're mentally positioned to capture assumptions which fit our desired personal outcome. We have to challenge and understand our own paradigms, our drivers, our fears, our needs, and our psychological minefields. How do we develop an understanding of what makes us act and respond to the way we do? We must understand. Mental conditioning through strategic planning makes us more proactive to situations and enables us to more quickly recognize fitting opportunities. We must listen with the intent to hear what is being said, especially to those who challenge our paradigms, the people who have thoughts that don't fit our thought patterns. We must understand from the other person's viewpoint. Then we must plan for the future financially. Here's the one thing I found in dealing with farmers that is one of the biggest struggles. When I ask people, okay, how much are you going to pay yourself? Well, they say, I pay myself $1,800 a month. Okay, what about your insurance? Oh, that's part of the farm. Well, what about your gas bill? Oh, that's part of the farm. What about your vehicles? Well, three of them, they're farm vehicles. One of them's not. And then the farmers say, well, I'm not making any money. I remember visiting a farmer friend of mine in the Midwest who asked for some assistance in marketing. And when I drove up to his house, he showed me his basketball court that was in the house and his helicopter and this and that and the other. And I said, well, how much of this is farm stuff and how much of it's, what do you pay yourself a year? Boy, he said, I don't pay myself very much. Well, it turned out that he was making lots of money, but he was paying himself as if he was running a $110 million a year income business. Pay yourself a fair wage. Understand what you're paying yourself. It may be that you may not be making as much money as you'd like to, but the reason is that you're overpaying yourself. Profits-only uses should be as tools for measurement, growth, and retirement. No other use. Understand and measure your use of depreciation dollars for growth. Procure inputs and market outputs from a manufacturing perspective. You bought the farm. You're going to grow a crop. You're going to use the inputs. So look forward. Forecast. What are those inputs going to cost me in the future years? Know the market and what the market is telling you. Make sure your banker, accountant, and insurance agents are part of strategic planning and that they understand the plans and the action steps. Here's a little spreadsheet that I like to use. It's use a cost of production, yield, cost per bushel, desired return on investment, needed price per bushel to get the desired return. Here, this farmer wants 50% rate of return. Well, he needs $8 a bushel. His current price at the time of this was $9.65. His differential to Portland was 61 cents. Local price was $9.04. Well, at that, he could get an improvement over cost of production at $278 an acre. It's easy to build these types of spreadsheets, and I know your local county agents and others will be more than glad to help. There is no crystal ball, but there is predictive intelligence. Predictive intelligence is mapping the future based on defined possibilities and probabilities of what will happen and your needed action steps, the bets that you're willing to make to capture positive results of defined goals. Define the potential of the future, then define what risks you're willing to take on and which risks you're willing to pass to others. Identify the necessary action steps, constraints, and timelines to accomplish the predicted goal. If you don't have a predicted goal, if you don't have a picture of the future, why are you even bothering to farm? Have a backup plan so you can be proactive to missed assumptions. The keys to successful marketing, you must have a vision of what you wish to accomplish over a long period of time. Understand yourself. Why do you think the way you do? What were your past decision-making pitfalls and shortcomings? Write it down. Refer to this list when making your marketing decisions. Plan and write down your short and long-term marketing strategy with if, when, and then statements. These can then be put in a simple Excel spreadsheet for execution. Include government programs and insurance products in your marketing strategies. Equip yourself with knowledge. How do insurance programs work? What is driving short-term marketing trends, the 1 month to 3 years? What may happen to change long-term trends beyond 1 year? What are the current world commodity competitive force trends? Country, weather, commodity mix, relative value, what are they telling us? What do the market experts think, not the coffee shop crowd? What price will return you the percent return on investment that you want each of the next 4 years? What price will return you the percent return on investment that you want for the next 4 years? If you can get that rate of return, why do you care how high the price goes? Mark your unsold inventory to market daily. This will help you equate dollars and strategy to inventory. Use the FSA programs. Loan. In years of low price, always use carry coupled with government loan 697 buyback program. programs and tools, even in forward contracts. Understand and use government-backed CRC insurance products to the maximum percentage. It's about revenue guarantee, not production guarantee. This is the greatest tool, and it's the closest to a free put that you will ever get in marketing. And beware of escalation. Because you missed the boat doesn't mean it will come back. The goal should be to make a greater than average return on investment, not to top the market. Write down an exposure limit. Prepare yourself in case extreme events happen. Give yourself a break. No one can predict the top or bottom of a market. Focus on price targets that return a desired rate of return over time. Be the low-cost producer per bushel. Today's commodity prices are created by supply and demand. Remember, all prices beyond today are created by speculative value coupled to the speculative value of time. Now, a lot of people say there haven't been any opportunities. Here's just a chart showing that last Friday's close, if you'll just look at Chicago wheat, the contract high for Chicago wheat since that contract has existed is 1060. December 09 was 1121. July of 10, 1113. December of 10, 1028. And July of 11, 1036. December of 11, 671. July of 12, 624. And likewise, you see these opportunities that have existed for Minneapolis, Chicago beans, Chicago corn. This is just to illustrate that time value is a great thing. Time value creates opportunity. Remember, that guy that's bidding for corn or wheat out there in 2011 or 12, he's doing it because he wants to make a bet. He's not doing it because he knows that's what the price is going to be. And what if the bank says, I gotta sell at harvest? Well, you know, you may have to sell at harvest because you need cash flow. If you're taking care of business, you're building working capital to where that's not the case. But if you know you're gonna have to sell at harvest, then look at the forward selling opportunities into the future. If not, then just accept the fact that time is going to tell you what to do. When you run out of time, you run out of options. When you're dealing 3 years in the future, you control your own options. Well, here's the price trends. Where's the market going to be in the future? Don't know. But there's opportunity now beyond current prices. If you look at the July 2010 Chicago futures at 510, that's a lot better than September current at 441. Does it get you the rate of return you want? I don't know. Only you can answer that question. Anything we can help you with, feel free to give us a call. The purpose of Mid-Columbia Producers Cooperative being in existence is to try to meet our vision of profitably exceed the expectations of our patrons and customers. Thank you for the opportunity to be a presenter. God bless you.
Don, how important do you think it is to carefully consider what the weaknesses we might see in an identified niche market?
I guess that's why I use the language thoughtful consideration because, two things. Customers' motivations and emotional connections with what they feel like they want from their food is changing and is not solid. And that's why even when I have producers come pretty happy that they've connected well with consumers, our newest message to them is generally do everything they can again to give these ways to make almost a community or an experiential additional value to the purchases they're making with them, so that part of the purchase really ends up being, there's two ways you could pose it. Part of it ends up being a service in the fact that the producer's also providing some direct assurances or access to a farm heritage the person wants to reconnect with. Or second, to think about actually, making it just like John Deere did long ago, making it part of a community where someone's own identity is somewhat a function of who they buy their food from. And you know, we've been speaking this a long time ago, but then when the USDA came out with Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food last week, I guess I've never been as succinct about saying it, but that's what I guess I feel like at least part of the consumer base is. And that is a risk management tool in and of itself, because once there's a face back on who you're doing business with, there tends to be a little stronger loyalty and less vagrancies to wherever the market forces take prices or the hot trend of the day.
Thank you. And the first question from our audience for you, Raleigh, is they want to know, do you have a book or some recommended reading to help them think about emotional aspects of marketing?
There are several. If you go into the web and type in the psychology of marketing, there are several articles and some books that can be helpful. I don't have any particular ones to mention right now, but one thing I can assure you is the successful marketers have the psychology part in check.
And Raleigh, you pointed at the high, the $15 high, and that when you were talking about the emotional aspects of marketing, impacts that might have, what percentage of grain got sold at that level or higher?
Oh, well, way less than 1%.
No, so there aren't very many people that hit that. Is that's that essence? That's, I think, right?
Well, the reason it was $15 is there was nothing for sale.
Oh. Okay. And your slides, you mentioned, and I've just referenced that marketing is an emotional endeavor. And this question's come in is, what strategy should a producer follow in recognition of that fact? You touched on that some in your slides. Do you want to give us a little more on that?
Real quickly, John, the elements of marketing are, number one, if a person can just sit down and figure out a rate of return and what price will reap them that rate of return that will make them very happy, then they can have a target out there in the distant future that will, they can always be searching for that number. People that are saying, okay, if I can get $4, or I can get $5, or I can get $6 for wheat, and they don't have how many bushels they're willing to sell at those numbers, they're waking up every day saying, is this a good price, or is this a good price, or is this a good price, but they don't have any targets.
And do you, I already asked, I'm sorry, I asked that question, I'm skipping around here. I'm going to come back to Don for a question, and then I'll come back to you, Raleigh, so don't go away. And I think we may have answered this directly to some folks. We had more than one person ask about how to get to market maker and kind of what's the links, Don, and do you have a simple way? Can they simply Google market maker?
What they should do. But yeah, that's exactly what you should do. But you can do general market maker, because that's actually a term that's used in the stock markets. So it's best if you put a state like Colorado market maker, Indiana market maker, New York market maker. The problem is, I think I saw in our original poll that these are mostly Western participants. And the West, part of the reason they recruited Colorado so heavily is the West is not represented well yet. And that's part of what I'm hoping to kind of remedy, because it's more valuable for us in Colorado, too, if our surrounding states have it. But if you do any state along with Market Maker, one of your first links will be Market Maker. And John did post the actual link to Colorado, but we also bought the website coloradomarketmaker.com, like many states have, so it's a little easier to share.
Good. And Raleigh, you talked about the importance of information, and Don, you can leave your mic on so that when we come back to you. Raleigh, you mentioned the importance of information, and someone here is asking, do you have other information sources where people should go look about the market and the source and that information they should track?
My goodness, the information that is available today is astronomical. You can go into almost any grain company's website and they all have links to different market groups and DTN and just Google World Grain Markets, International Grains Council. The information is it's astronomical, the amount of information that is out there. But the important thing is you also need to find one or two people that you can trust that you can use them as people run strategies by. But the information, John, is everywhere.
And Don, you pointed to some successful collaborations, marketing collaborations, do you have some pointers that could be recommended to folks to how you put a collaboration together like that, or what are some of the critical things of making a collaboration work?
I have been really lucky to mostly run into collaborations that were already in place and figured out how to work together the best they can. So I wish I had some magical words, but I guess what we have seen in some case studies, well, there's two ways to collaborate, too. There's very much the still arm's length contractual things that happen with some alliances where it is, you know, very much about just getting economies of scale together or attacking a market together. Those are the ones I've not dealt with as much, but the ones that have really been able to build a sense of community where, again, they're probably getting some of their customer loyalty even from the fact that they think the customer believes they're part of something that's just a great business model are, definitely along the lines of being very clear. They don't have the sense of desperation, like, we really, really, really need you, so please join our thing. It's very much about making it almost an honor to be invited to be a part of the group, being very, very sure that there's a very similar, if not unified, vision about what their values are and what they believe in, both in terms of the heritage of their ag system and the food that they're offering to people, and then very much a sense of realizing each other's strengths and limitations and kind of dividing and conquering, so that not everybody does have to know exactly everything that's going on with the financial part, or not everybody has to be manning a table at a retail sampling site or a farmer's market, and that they actually learn to share based on what each of them is willing, good at, and able to do.
Don, do you have some other, you pointed to Market Maker. Are there some other resource sites that you could point to that would be good resources when people are thinking about niche markets or are already there and wanting to expand or strengthen? Are there some places out there you would recommend people go looking for good source information?
Yeah, because Market Maker has done very little on educational materials, but probably the newest innovation is the Good Food Network, which is a Kellogg initiative that is trying to pull together case studies and examples of everything from farm to school to supply chain partnerships and to direct retail partnerships that are happening across the country, and that represents every region. So if you Google again Good Food Network and put Kellogg into it, there should be some good materials. The other thing I didn't know about till I actually wrote one is the Ag Marketing Service runs a federal state marketing improvement program, grant program. And even if you're not in the mood to write a grant, I can't believe how many people have found me through finding that there was a project report written about something I did that they wanted to mimic in their state. So sometimes it's actually, this isn't as much true for the pure research grants out of CSRES, although there's more and more of those that are extension-oriented. But if you look at Ag Marketing Services Federal State Marketing Improvement Program, there has been a grant written about almost every marketing topic by some state that you could imagine, and all of them are supposed to be willing to share those reports if the Ag Marketing Service doesn't have them themselves. But a lot of this stuff and research has been looked at pretty directly already, very much in an extension orientation, and that's an underutilized resource that I don't think they've figured out how to package yet.
Oh, thank you very much. And Raleigh, would you have one final wrap-up piece of advice to give folks that are in the commodity, having to market into commodity markets?
I guess the one word of advice is beware of the minefields. And the minefields most generally have nothing to do with economics. They have everything to do with psychology. The opportunities that we've had for the next 3 years, over the last 3 years, are astronomical. Farmers have had opportunities to lock in prices that they only dreamed of, yet they did very little of, and it had nothing to do with economics. It had everything to do with psychology. So I would say to everyone in the audience, whether you're a producer or whether you're an educator or a banker, whatever field of endeavor we're in, that we need to really, if we're going to help people economically, first we have to understand how we all together can band together to navigate those psychological minefields.
Well, Don and Raleigh, I want to thank you very much for very informative presentations. And there's one last polling question coming up here we'd like the audience to respond to. But here in just the closing minutes then, I'd like to, if there's something you missed in these presentations, those will be up on our Ag and Uncertain Times website, so you can go back through them, review them, something you missed. They both have really good information in them. And some pointing to some other places, and we're going to pull a pod on here now, which has all of the web links that our presenters have talked about. That, well, not all that they've talked about, some of them. Also, our web link for Ag and Uncertain Times webpage, which gets you to all of those past presentations. We welcome people to pull those down, use them, take them to your educational meetings or your meeting of your local farm bureau or grain growers whatever groups you're associated with. They're on target. Information there is excellent. And I welcome you to come back on October the 7th when we'll be back with a series really targeted at working with farm and ranch families who find themselves caught in some type of a financial stress or crisis, and we've been able to line up a very good and experienced set of presenters. Our kind of kickoffs presenter is Dave Gaylor from Nebraska, who spent a lot of time working with farm families during the crisis of the 80s, and has actually continued in that work up to the present day, and so will provide some really good insights on as we think about this. And we do believe, given the kind of the economic situation that's kind of settling over ag, is that there are likely to be some of our friends, neighbors, and colleagues who find themselves in some role where some of the tips that come out of this might be very useful to them. So you can download any of these three files that you see there on your screen. You just click on the Save to My, you identify the file name, click on the Save to My Computer button that's there, follow the instructions, it'll download that right to your own computer. I guarantee you these are virus-free files, and so you won't have to have written to get the Ag in Uncertain Times web link. Thank you to Don and Raleigh, and for Don, she referenced the Homestead Ranches and beef, and we were privileged in our meeting here at Grand Junction to have them come and give a presentation and talk very specifically how they had used the very information that Don was putting up there and how it had really strengthened their bottom line in terms of targeting their marketing. One interesting piece out of that was that research and the analysis of the margin showed that the restaurants was the lowest margins and was some of the most difficult markets to keep. And so it helped them make some very informed decisions about how to strengthen their marketing and improve their bottom line. So I had a first-hand experience of the application of that, and in my work in Eastern Washington, I've seen the results of Raleigh's work, and it was interesting to discover that with his elevator and his cooperative, the majority of his producers have most of their crop priced. So thank you again to you all, and we look forward to seeing you on October the 7th.